From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Take Two. Me, Martinez. It's one thing for the city of LA to say they want to reimagine policing. It's another thing to take steps in that direction, which the city council seemed to do today. Find out what they're planning on. Plus, California will now allow up to 3 households to socialize outdoors. We'll ask an expert what this means for your holiday party plans. It's all coming up on Take Two. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org, this is Take Two. I'm Amy Martinez. Coming up, the Supreme Court ruled to end the census count early with not a whole lot of explanation.
This is the equivalent of the court saying, because I said so. And if that's an unsatisfying rationale to get from your parents, it's a particularly unsatisfying rationale to get from what is purportedly a court.
More on that just ahead. But first, across California and the nation, the spotlight on police violence has energized longstanding efforts to stop using law enforcement to deal with people having a mental health crisis. This past June, the LA City Council approved a measure that would develop an unarmed model of response for nonviolent calls. And we saw some movement on that at the City Council meeting today. KPCC's Robert Grova is here to tell us all about it. So, Robert, what do we get out of the City Council meeting today?
Yeah, so today they voted to move towards setting up a pilot program that would send out unarmed civilians who are trained to handle individuals dealing with substance abuse or a mental health crisis of some sort, as well as other calls that don't involve violence, like welfare checks. Here's what Councilman Herb Wesson had to say today.
Today is an opportunity for us as a city to make a giant first step in putting in place professional unarmed response.
Yeah, so today the council directed staff to come up with requests for proposals from nonprofit organizations that would run this pilot program.
Now, Robert, you did some reporting on this issue over the summer and the push to take law enforcement out of the equation. What'd you find?
Well, you know, figuring out how to respond to mental health, substance abuse, and other behavioral crisis calls is very complicated. Many advocates agree that where we are now, you know, where police are the de facto first responders, is the tip of the iceberg, you know, decades of failing to care for people living with a mental illness or substance abuse disorder. There are several programs that already take a step in the direction of removing police from crisis calls. I looked at the LAPD's Mental Evaluation Unit, or MEU. A big part of their work involves sending out 2-person teams, one officer, one clinician from the Department of Mental Health. They try to defuse the situation and get the person help rather than arrest them. Last year, that unit got about 20,000 calls. We could only respond to about 40% of them. And staffing at that unit has roughly doubled in the past 5 years. Still, in recent years, LAPD cops have shot at dozens of people perceived to have mental health issues. What we're seeing with the push at the city council is an effort to take police out of the equation entirely. We should know there's a program in Eugene, Oregon called CAHOOTS that's had a lot of success with this. And it's that program that's being held up as a model nationally. And you know, the motion the council approved today is looking to model LA's program after this CAHOOTS program.
Yeah, I've heard about that one. Tell us some more about the CAHOOTS program.
Yeah, over the summer, I talked with Benjamin Brubaker, who helps run the program. Here's what he had to say about their non-law enforcement model.
Having a different group be able to go and connect those people back into resources and be able to just sit and spend some time with them listening and helping them process through whatever struggles that they're having, I think is really the more appropriate response.
You know, another CAHOOTS staffer told NPR that out of about 24,000 calls last year, the team had to ask for police backup less than 1% of the time. But we have to remember that Eugene is a lot different from LA. There are only 170,000 people about in Eugene, while the city of LA, you know, we've got 4 million. So I think that's why you see in the motion that was approved today that the council is asking for population, racial demographics, number of languages spoken, and other things that make LA unique to be taken into consideration, you know, when we set up this pilot.
Yeah, this continues to be such a fraught issue. You mentioned, Robert, because people that are going through mental health crisis are still getting shot.
Yeah, you know, our colleague Frank Stoltz has been reporting on a shooting that took place just last week. An LA County Sheriff's deputy shot and critically injured a man inside Harbor UCLA Medical Center. The Sheriff's Department says the man was smashing medical equipment before he, quote, turned his attention towards a deputy. The hospital says the patient was experiencing a psychiatric crisis. medical staff at UCLA are angry about the incident. They held a protest last night. A doctor at the hospital said the deputy should have let the hospital handle the patient, since Harbor UCLA has specialized staff who are trained to de-escalate situations like this. Today we heard Sheriff Alex Villanueva say, you know, that the deputy didn't have time to wait. But, you know, helping someone going through a mental health crisis is a very difficult job that does take a lot of training. You know, last week I was in the checkout line at a Target, and there was a man who was clearly going through a crisis. There were four officers there to respond, and you know, they had the difficult job of defusing the situation, which when you're dealing with screaming and scared customers is never an easy thing to do. You know, and everyone I've spoken with in reporting on this larger issue of cops and mental health crisis calls, from social workers to advocates to police officers themselves, have said police don't want to be the de facto first responders on these types of calls. You know, the fact is there just isn't a program large enough to step in right now. So, you know, it's going to be really interesting to see what type of program LA comes up with.
All right. That's KPCC's Robert Garova. Robert, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Moving on, yesterday afternoon, the Supreme Court gave the Trump administration permission to end the 2020 census early. And then last night, the Census Bureau announced plans to do just that. For now, the 2020 census is set to end tomorrow, October 15th. This is the latest in a series of back and forths as the end date of the census is litigated in court. Caroline Champlin has been making sense of the census for us here at KPCC for a few months. She joins us now to talk about these decisions. Now, before we jump into all this news, Caroline, how did the 2020 census schedule end up in this legal battle to begin with?
Right. Well, the end date for the census was initially moved to October 31st because of the pandemic and all these delays it caused. And then this legal battle started in August after the Trump administration suddenly announced it was going to cut the 2020 census short by a month to September 30th. And the city of LA and a bunch of nonprofits challenged that because they believe that a rush census will miss people, especially in Los Angeles, which has one of the most challenging populations to count in the country. And that's because so many people here are renters or live in really dense units. And those at risk of being overlooked are largely communities of color. And a federal judge agreed with those concerns, and she extended the count again until the end of October. That was supposed to give census takers more time to follow up at people's houses and make sure they respond. But the government wasn't happy about that extension, and they appealed it, and twice they got denied. But then yesterday, the Supreme Court looked at the case, and they sided with the government to stay the extension. And that essentially gave the Census Bureau the opportunity to end the count whenever. And last night, they took that opportunity, and they announced the census will end on October 15th. So barring any last-minute legal challenges or reversals, tomorrow will be the last day you can submit a census form over the internet, over the phone, or by mail. And if you miss it, the next chance will be in a decade.
Well, okay then, Caroline. So I got to ask then, what's the big deal that the census is expected to end this week? I mean, if the government says the count is 99.9% complete, what would an extra 2 weeks get us?
That's right. Yeah, the Census Bureau says they're ending the count because they've counted almost all the households in the country. But the thing is, we don't know how those households were counted. And completion doesn't necessarily mean that everyone filled out the census questionnaire on their own, because sometimes census takers count people by just asking their neighbors for their information, or they take what's called a pop count, which means they just try to estimate who lives in a certain house. And those are both less accurate methods than individually helping someone complete their form or the household filling it out on their own. So the plaintiffs in the lawsuit are really disappointed, and so are the people doing advocacy work in Los Angeles. This morning, I just talked to a woman named Cynthia Cortez with Cella Collaborative. Here's what she told me about this completion issue.
It's very troublesome that this 99% caseload is not truly 99% of the people that live here.
Her group had been planning events to encourage people to self-respond to the census, so do it on their own and produce a sort of more accurate response. But now all of those events that they had planned are being canceled.
Then why did the Supreme Court let the Census Bureau choose to end the count after two lower courts said it should keep going until the end of the month?
So what's crazy here is that we don't actually know why the Supreme Court made this decision. They didn't release any explanation for staying those lower court rulings. And really, when they release a stay, that's just meant to be a pause button while a case is being reviewed in court. And it's supposed to be a temporary order. But in this case, the timing was really urgent. The count was supposed to go until October 31st. And by allowing the Census Bureau this window to end the count now, the consequences of a stay are actually becoming permanent. Here's how Loyola law professor Justin Levitt explained it to me.
This is the Supreme Court's way of making a decision while pretending not to make a decision. And the fact that it did so without any explanation whatsoever is really just sheer power and not law. This is the equivalent of the court saying, because I said so. And if that's an unsatisfying rationale to get from your parents, it's a particularly unsatisfying rationale to get from what is purportedly a court.
Okay, I don't mean to laugh, Caroline, but I mean, is it really just because I said so? I mean, the count ends tomorrow. Anything at all that the plaintiffs can do?
Right. So I asked that question to Mike Feuer, the city attorney of LA. He was involved in this lawsuit against the Trump administration. And he told me rather cryptically that they do have some other legal options that they plan to announce sometime soon. He wouldn't say what, and I couldn't handle the suspense of waiting to find out what he meant. So I asked Justin Levitt if he had any ideas. And he said the plaintiffs might seek another preliminary injunction against the Census Bureau to try to move this date again. But they would probably need to present a slightly different argument to avoid it getting shot down by the Supreme Court. But the thing is, we don't know why their original argument didn't satisfy the justices. So it's hard to know where to start up again. And the plaintiffs could also just hustle to get a final decision from the lower court judge, because that still hasn't happened. And there's also this appeal pending in the Ninth Circuit. But in the meantime, the clock is ticking. The Census Bureau has already released the new end date, and it's tomorrow, and they're likely planning to lay off staff. And so once that happens, it would really be a challenge to undo these decisions.
That's KPCC's Caroline Champlin making sense of the census. Caroline, thanks a lot.
Thank you, A.
So, while the census count comes to an end, so do the days of essentially parking wherever you want in Los Angeles. See, traffic cops are going to go back to handing out $73 tickets for street sweep violations starting tomorrow. This after Mayor Eric Garcetti relaxed restrictions back in March. That was at the start of the pandemic. Also, rules will be enforced again when it comes to abandoned and oversized vehicles, overnight parking, and peak hour and anti-gridlock zones, not to mention expired registration. So hopefully you got your stuff all together. Now, the move comes after the LA City Council found that it was receiving complaints about trash piling up on roadways and city revenue was dropping as well. Up until this point, parking rules have not been enforced due to COVID-19, which, as we all know, has cost many Angelenos their jobs and has forced many to work from home, creating more competition to get those close to home parking spots. So, as a final warning, ticketing resumes tomorrow. You heard it right here. All right, California will now allow up to 3 households to socialize outdoors. Now, you still have to wear masks, follow other guidelines, but the point is you'll be able to get back some of the normal that we normally would be having this time of year. Halloween, Thanksgiving, all the holiday parties you'd be planning for December. We're going to ask an expert what this could mean to close out 2020. She's next when Take 2 continues in 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on the KPCC app. I'm Ian Martinez. California has maintained a pretty good trajectory of declining COVID-19 cases in recent weeks, and hospitalizations are at the lowest point in 6 months. And here in LA County, the positivity rate is also declining. So generally speaking, most people seem to be playing by the rules. But the holidays are coming, which means that desire to not social distance might be pretty great. To discuss this and answer other coronavirus-related questions, we have with us Paula Cannon. She's a virologist with the Keck School of Medicine at USC. So, Professor Cannon, first off, what can or what should we be reading into the latest numbers about how we're doing in LA County specifically?
Okay. Well, I think it depends if you're a glass half full or glass half empty kind of person. Our numbers are staying pretty steady, although maybe we've had a bit of an uptick. Our daily rates are over 1,000, 1,125 a day at the moment. And we'd actually dipped below 1,000 about 3 weeks ago. So I think it's still kind of holding steady. We're carefully watching it, but nothing that's kind of freaking anybody out at the moment.
We're so thirsty to get back to normal, Professor. I think we'll take any water, even a drop in that in that glass. Governor Gavin Newsom has loosened restrictions around social gatherings this week. Remind us what the rules are now.
Sure. So he's allowed up to 3 households to socialize together outdoors, as long as they continue to follow, you know, the rules about wearing masks and socially distancing. But the big news is that 3 households can now get together. And I think, you know, it's important to stress that, you know, he's probably done this as a sort of a preemptive strike. It's kind of stop people having really big parties and instead say, okay, we'll see how you guys go with 3 households. And if we can follow those rules and behave well, then, you know, maybe we can open up a bit more after that.
Now, the thing is, Professor, you know this, I know this, and I'm sure the governor knows this deep down, that people will have their own interpretations of what 3 households means. So what's your best advice here for people?
Yeah, I think I would say don't understand the why behind this new rule, not just obsess over the details, and don't try and game the system. You know, don't go inviting the 3 largest families you know. And also think about the composition of people you may invite to hang out in your backyard or at a local park. You know, if you've got elderly members of the family who we know are more vulnerable, then maybe you should make the gathering even smaller. Maybe just you and the grandparents, for example. So, you know, think about the event. Don't just be like, yay, I can have 3 households and I don't have to take any other factors into consideration.
And maybe be discerning, right? I mean, you can't contact trace these people, obviously. Maybe you can, I don't know. But at the very least, if you know for a fact that one household has been loosey-goosey with the rules over the past few months, maybe you don't invite that household.
Oh, absolutely. I always say, you know, etiquette's gone out the window.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
You can just, you can invite the people you know, obey the rules in the same way you do. And that way you can have your event and also not be kind of panicking the whole time. You can feel better about it yourself.
Yeah, it's being polite when it comes to the pandemic. Yeah, that's over with. We got to keep it real. Okay, about Halloween now, Professor. The state's top health official said this week that trick-or-treating is permitted depending on local rules. I know Beverly Hills just canceled Halloween. Well, at least canceled trick-or-treating, I should say. But it's not really a good idea. LA County has advised against it. But for those neighborhoods that might consider it, Professor, review the pros and cons of this particular activity this year.
Yeah, I always think that trick-or-treating means different things to different age groups, you know, and it may not necessarily be just you and your family walking through a deserted neighborhood, you know. So the issues are, if you're going to have crowding on streets, you know, maybe avoid those areas that have the good candy, you know, this year. And if people get together in groups, especially young people, you know, the trick-or-treating then may lead to a party and other things that we're trying to discourage. So, you know, there's a lot of things to think about if you're thinking about how to do trick-or-treating safely.
What might be a better alternative? I know staying home and not doing it at all, that's the best. I understand that. But
so I'm thinking in terms of let's reclaim it for the youngest children. You know, decorate your house. That's what we've done, you know, so that families can go on car rides around neighborhoods. You know, maybe if you've got young children yourself, you can get in the car with your own, you know, bag of candy and you can make a game, you know, hey, first one to see a witch crashing into a tree gets, you know, their first pick of the candy, something like that. And also, you know, we have, where I live, you know, we have neighbors who've got 2 small preschool children. And so what we've done is we've decorated our house and I'm going to be coordinating with the neighbors and saying, hey, do your kids want to come over at a certain time? And we'll leave candy for them and we'll either sit on the lawn or we'll wave from the window or, you know, probably my husband will jump up behind the curtain to give them the, you know, the full Halloween experience. But I'm going to try and work with them to give their youngest children a bit of a trick-or-treat experience. That's how I think about it.
So putting kids first. Wow, what a novel concept, Professor. Can't believe no one's thought of that. On the topic of social gatherings, here's one specific question from LaShawn Williams, who wrote into us to ask, can I have a party of 25 at the park?
Oh, Lordy, LaShawn, you still have to ask. yeah, you know, the answer is no. And it's no because 25 is a big number. Yeah. You know, those 25 people are going to be returning to their families and their communities. And unfortunately, we now know this is how COVID is currently spreading. We call this community transmission, but it's down to these types of gatherings. So 25 is just, it's too many. And, you know, Governor Newsom said three families maximum. So, you know, there are going to be three pretty big families to make that number. So, no, please don't have that party.
You hear that, LaShawn? No 25 party at the park. Yeah. Okay. Now, shifting gears to amusement parks, there have been a bit of a controversy over the fact that Disneyland and others have not been able to open in California. Governor Newsom is sending a group to Disneyland in Florida, in Orlando, to see how it's managing to stay open during the pandemic, to get ideas maybe on how it could work here. My question to you, Professor, if you were part of this group that was heading to Orlando to review what they've been doing, and your job was to come back here with news about what works and what doesn't at Disney World, what kinds of things would you be looking for?
Yeah, I've been waiting for that phone call, but they haven't asked me. So, you know, theme parks are really, opening them is a Herculean task because it's got all the elements. It's got crowds, it's got people from many different parts of the country eating, screaming, laughing, and sitting close together on rides. So, you know, it's really difficult. But having said that, you know, I think Disney could probably manage it well because Disney visitors, at least my observation, is that in general, they're good rule followers. So I would expect people to wear their masks, especially if they're, you know, cute Mickey Mouse masks. And also, as we know, Disney are very good at managing crowds and lines. But again, the problem is that with these numbers of people, you're just statistically certain that there's going to be many COVID-infected people in that park. And then the consequences of people spreading that infection to new people who then go home to very distributed communities, again, that's how this virus will keep spreading. And that's why theme parks are just so difficult at the moment.
Yeah, the math makes it pretty obvious of what could happen after that. And I would imagine your concern probably stems from the fact that if we open amusement parks, concerts will be next. And that's a different situation with people close together, screaming and yelling and having a great time.
Yeah, especially if it's an indoor concert. Oh, you know, I mean, again, you know, you could think maybe outdoor, maybe with people very separated, a well-behaved crowd at the Hollywood Bowl, maybe. But, you know, even then you have to think about entrance and exit events and people will get crowded at those points.
We're talking to USC Professor of Molecular Biology and Immunology, Paula Cannon. All right, now to something a little more somber. Over the weekend, it was reported that another child in L.A. County has been diagnosed with multi-symptom inflammatory syndrome. That's a rare condition believed to be related to COVID-19. That brings the total cases here since the pandemic to 41. Professor, we've talked about this on the show before, but can you remind us what this syndrome is and why it's believed to be connected to the coronavirus?
Yeah, sure. So this is very rare, but it is something that children can get about 2 to 4 weeks after they get infected with COVID. And although we don't understand it fully, we believe it's probably, if you like, an excessive immune response related to COVID. And, you know, the symptoms include fever, stomachache, vomiting, diarrhea, extreme tiredness. And most of the children actually do end up in hospital with this.
What's the age range of the kids that are largely coming down with this? And is there any indication as to why they're coming down with this?
Yeah, it's between about 3 and 12, so elementary, middle school kids. Average, I think, is about 8 years old. And again, we're not entirely sure, but it's probably to do with the different types of immune systems that, you know, children have versus adults, especially in this age range.
What's been the impact on these kids who've contracted it?
Well, in LA, I mean, we're lucky in that of the 41 now cases we've had, none of these children have died. But as I said, all of them have been in hospital, and about half of those cases were serious enough that they needed to be in the ICU. So it's rare, but it can be very, very serious.
Now, the state and now the county has loosened restrictions around playgrounds, too. And the county is accepting waivers from schools that want to at least start teaching the youngest kids in person. Now, given this, Professor, how concerned should we be about the risks posed by pediatric syndrome? And how should we proceed as we go out and just be about in public with our kids, with our children?
Yes. So again, you know, I want to stress that this, you know, multi-system inflammatory syndrome is extremely rare. But, you know, you should still be worried about your kids getting COVID, and you should be worried because they can also spread it to other people, including, you know, more vulnerable older adults. So as you are venturing out into those playgrounds that are now opening up, you know, just make sure you follow the rules. You know, if your child is two or older, they need to wear a mask. Everybody needs to stay socially distanced, 6 foot apart. No eating or drinking, because that makes you take off your mask. And visits are supposed to be limited to 30 minutes, and there'll be maximum numbers at each playground. So, you know, if people follow the rules, you know, you should be okay. We worry when people don't follow the rules, of course.
2 years old, you said. 2 years old and older should be wearing a
mask.
Yes. Okay, just to be clear. One thing today we found out, Melania Trump, the first lady, posted a letter on the White House's website. And in the letter, she said that her 14-year-old son, Barron, tested positive back when she did and the president did. Professor, what do we need to keep in mind when a seemingly healthy teenager tests positive? Right? He's tested negative since, according to the first lady. But what do we need to keep in mind? What's different about how doctors may handle, say, a teenager as opposed to an adult?
Sure. Well, I just saw that report, so I'm glad he's now tested negative and is recovered. So again, most teenagers who get infected are going to have no or very mild symptoms. So, you know, keep an eye on them. But maybe one of the bigger challenges, if you're the parent of that teenager, is how to stop them spreading that infection to somebody else. And especially if they don't really have symptoms and they feel okay. And, you know, 2 weeks, you know, the idea of 2 weeks of quarantine if you have COVID, that's an awful long time for a teenager. So helping them with the sort of frustration of it, I think, is something you know, a parent should think about.
Would it help with teenagers? I know that I used to be a teenager, Paul. I tend to not tell the truth when I was a teenager, or just, you know, that's the way I was. Mm-hmm. But is it help to, you know, kind of do a contact tracing question session with them to find out maybe where they've been or who they've hung out with?
Sure. And especially if you frame it as a kind of, you know, no blame kind of question. So I think, you know, helping your children to understand we're all in this together. You don't get COVID because you're a bad person or you behave badly necessarily. But part of us keeping everybody in our families and the community safe is to be able to be honest about things like that. So I would frame it like that. Ask them if they can think of anybody they may have inadvertently, you know, infected. And then let's just pass on that information to other people so they can also quarantine themselves or go and get tested. And let's stop this spread.
One more thing, and I want to switch gears and end with a broader audience question that I'm sure a lot of people wonder from time to time. It's from Casey Gonzalez, and he asks, are mask requirements going to stay mandatory forever? Professor, you know, before all of this happened, I've always wanted to wear a mask, but I always felt ashamed. I'll admit it. I felt ashamed that people would look at me. Now, forever, if I'm outdoors anywhere near people or have to go to the supermarket, I don't care if we have a vaccine, Professor, I'm still wearing a mask no matter what. And I know that we can't predict the future, but I'm wondering, based on your expertise, how long will be expected to wear masks every day when outside of our homes, you think?
Sure. Well, you know, I can only guess. I think it's going to depend a lot on the next 3 months, like through the end of the year. If we can keep our numbers under control, then soon we're going to enter a next phase where there's going to be vaccines coming online, at least, you know, for the most vulnerable people. And then maybe we can all breathe a little easier. Oh, actually, no pun intended there. You know, when we get to that stage. But for now, I would just say, like you, learn to love your masks. It's the single best tool we have. And every action of putting on a mask says that you are part of the fight to get us back to normal more quickly.
I don't know if I can go back to not wearing a mask when I'm not somewhere that I'm familiar with or around people I know. I don't think I can mentally and emotionally get over it anymore. No, I don't. I know I kid around a lot, but on that, I'm very serious. I don't know if I can do it anymore.
Yeah, I miss lipstick, you know? I can't wait to go back to lipstick.
I would agree with you there. I've just never tried it. Paula Cannon is a virologist with the Keck School of Medicine of USC. Paula, as always, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Dave.
All right, is the door to reopening Disneyland ajar? Just a little bit. Well, Maybe it is, and we might be able to throw in Universal Studios in that list as well. Also, before the president got his current job in the Oval Office, he was the ruler of the boardroom in the NBC TV show The Apprentice. And while he was there, he made sure everyone knew who was the boss. Find out how when Take Two continues. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and on the KPCC app, I'm E. Martinez. Disney lays the blame for its financial woes on Governor Newsom, but Senator Elizabeth Warren calls out Disney leadership for restoring their executive pay while laying off hundreds. And we're hearing more about Donald Trump's history with the Apprentice franchise at NBC. For all of this, plus a look at the new iPhone, we go on the lot.
Head out and yell.
You want a chocolate?
All right, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up.
With us always is Rebecca Keegan, senior film editor at The Hollywood Reporter. Okay, Rebecca, so one afternoon 5 years ago, back when human beings used to go inside movie theaters, remember that those great days?
I do,
yeah,
the good old days.
I randomly chose a film to go see that I knew nothing about. It was called Tangerine, about a trans sex worker in L.A., and I really liked it. And then I liked it even more when I found out that it was shot entirely on an iPhone. And yesterday, Apple announced its new iPhone 12, and Rebecca, Hollywood has been a buzz. Tell us so why.
Yeah, I really liked Tangerine too. Yeah. And that was many, many iPhones ago. That was shot on an iPhone 5S. That's how long ago that was. And as you pointed out, we are now up to iPhone 12. And this new iPhone is much jazzier than the one that made Tangerine. It has 5G, so it'll be faster. But in terms of specifically the filmmaking capabilities, it has Dolby Vision, which means that the video is sort of more luminous, more colorful, more dynamic. It has a video system with longer focal lengths and wider view. It also has the ability to sort of connect the set to the post-production house. You can literally edit on the phone as well.
So what are people in Hollywood saying about what the new iPhone will be able to do for them?
Well, Apple unveiled the phone with an ad shot by Emmanuel Lubezki, who's the cinematographer who shot The Revenant, Birdman, Gravity, just sort of the ultimate endorsement in terms of Hollywood filmmaking. And Lubezki makes the point in the ad that when he got into movie making, you needed big, complicated, expensive equipment, much of which is replaced by this device, which you can get for about $1,000. My colleague at The Hollywood Reporter, Carolyn Giardina, also spoke to a VFX pro, Ben Grossman. He's the guy who was the VFX supervisor in The Lion King. And he, too, is saying that a lot of the hardware setup that's on movie sets will now be in your pocket. And again, costing a lot less than what folks are used to.
Amazing. A movie set in your pocket. What will those creatives think of next? All right. Now, moving to Disney news. Monday, we mentioned on the show that California Governor Gavin Newsom is sending a staff to Disney World in Florida to find out how they've handled their reopening there. And word is they might make another stop.
Yeah, they may also stop at Universal Studios in Orlando. Now, Gavin Newsom has said he's in no hurry to open either Disneyland here in California or our Universal Studios. He is, you know, looking at this much more, I think, conservatively than they have been in Florida. And for that, Newsom has been targeted by Disney. Disney says that he is to blame for their 28,000 layoffs they just announced because of this stalemate over reopening the parks.
Yeah, and Disney has squarely put the blame on Newsom for the layoffs. But Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, in a letter, blamed Disney bosses Bob Chapek and Bob Iger. What did she say to them?
Well, Warren criticized Disney for prioritizing shareholders and executive pay over workers. She noted that shortly before these layoffs were announced, the executives who had had their pay cut since the start of the pandemic had their pay fully restored. She also pointed out that the company has issued some $47.9 billion in stock buybacks between 2009 and 2018, which is a common but somewhat controversial way that companies reward investors, and Warren believes reward investors over their own workers.
Now, also this week, Disney made an announcement that got a big reaction out of Wall Street. And whenever I hear that, I always shed a tear for my 401k. Rebecca, what did Disney say this time?
Well, the company announced a reorganization that really centers its focus on the streaming business. It's film and TV studios, it's broadcast cable networks, it's new streaming services like Disney Plus and ESPN Plus are all being combined into a single content business. And the key distribution decisions about that content will be made by an executive named Kareem Daniel, who comes over from the consumer products division and is a new face to a lot of people in Hollywood.
How is this this move more than just a reorganization?
Well, you know, normally reorganization means shifting who reports to whom. So Rebecca is now A's boss, say, or, you know, you combine a few parts of a company into one division. This is really a total reshaping of all of Disney's content businesses, which have operated separately as studios and networks. Now they're all under one umbrella.
Talking to Rebecca Keegan on the lot, A. Martinez's new boss. Let's move on to our last story, Trump and NBC. Today was announced that NBC will host a Trump town hall tomorrow night opposite Joe Biden's ABC event. But that's just the latest in a long history between the network and Trump. And The Hollywood Reporter today has new details about how his time there went with The Apprentice. What are those details?
Yeah, this comes from a story by my colleagues Kim Masters and Leslie Goldberg. And they look at this relationship Trump has had with NBC and the money that he made from that show, which goes beyond what his sort of salary was. Apparently, NBC would pay donations to the Trump Foundation in order to get Trump to do what they wanted him to do. For instance, when they wanted him to show up to the upfronts, which is something normally talent does, they had to pay $500,000. They had to pay $10,000 to his charity. Later, when they wanted him to stay on and when he was thinking about leaving in 2011, they had to pay $500,000 to his charity. What makes this especially rich is that the Trump Foundation is not really a charity. It was dissolved in 2019 after the New York Attorney General alleged a, quote, shocking pattern of illegality.
Now, if I remember, Rebecca, both of those shows, they were successful, right, for NBC and for Donald Trump?
Certainly, as we know from these recent New York Times reports on Trump's taxes for Trump, I mean, he made $197 million from the show and $230 million from the fame associated with the show. The Apprentice also kind of helped transform Trump's image from that of a sort of cartoonish New York developer to an allegedly successful businessman. And of course, he parlayed that into his presidential run. At the same time, NBC started to soften its news coverage of Trump's business failures when it was making him a reality TV star.
What about working with Donald Trump day to day? What stories do people have that were close to him and the show? What do they have to share?
Well, it sounds a lot like working with Trump in the White House, from what we hear. He often tried to get his showrunners fired. The production kind of had to build systems to keep Trump focused and sort of on the rails. He wanted to make the boardroom scenes in The Apprentice longer to highlight himself more. He wanted them to be about 80-90% of the show. But you know, a lot of the revenue from the show came from the tasks the contestants were supposed to carry out. Those were sponsored by Fortune 500 companies. So they had to keep reminding Trump that, yes, the money is coming from these companies. We have to give them some airtime. And he also just wanted the "you're fired" section of the show to be much bigger.
I mean, that was the best part, but because it was such a small moment, you build up to that small moment and he gets to deliver the line. That's kind of, maybe he knows more about TV than I do. Ultimately, Rebecca, you think it was all worth it for NBC to be in the Donald Trump business?
Well, I guess the fact that NBC has agreed to air Trump's town hall opposite Biden's on ABC suggests that someone at the network still thinks it's good to be in the Donald Trump business. I'm not sure some of the company's vocal liberal on-air talent, like, say, Rachel Maddow, would necessarily agree with that judgment.
You know what? I've never been that interested in the ratings for a town hall, a presidential town hall. But because the Biden and the Trump town halls are going to be on at the same time, one on NBC, one at ABC, can you imagine if one is more highly rated than the other, how that fallout will come down the next day?
I do hope we can pick our president based on more than ratings, because being good TV isn't good leadership. I hope that we can sort of look at it with a broader lens than that. But certainly that's the lens that Trump likes and is hoping will apply. And he's certainly hoping folks will tune in to NBC.
Rebecca Keegan is the Hollywood Reporter senior film editor. You can read her tweets at @ThatRebecca. Rebecca, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Egg.
More Take Two coming up in 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and online at kpcc.org. I'm E. Martinez. I left my cranberry juice in the other room. Can someone get that for me? At a time when journalism outlets are laying off or furloughing staff, it seems that the New York Times is thriving. One particular area of growth is in their podcast division. When they launched The Daily in January 2017, it wasn't exactly clear how a traditional print outlet would translate to audio. Now it's one of the most popular podcasts out there, and thanks to NPR affiliates such as KPCC, it also has a broadcast audience. A new Times podcast is Sway, hosted by op-ed writer Kara Swisher. She previously hosted the popular tech pod Recode Decode for Recode. This week, Swisher joins Nick Kwa on his LAS studio show about the podcast industry called Servant of Pod. Nick says Sway borrows some from Kira's previous show.
So while Recode Decode was kind of a standard, like, talking to big wigs and interesting people interview show, you know, like, not unlike Servant of Pod, Sway has a bit of a different feel because she built the show with a kind of a specific theme and target in mind. While it's still a newsy podcast in a bunch of ways, she's essentially trying to use the show as a frame to explore, like, different ideas and aspects of power. Who has it, how it's manifested, how it's wielded. It's a really interesting frame, and it gives the show sort of a nice thematic quality that removes the feeling of arbitrariness that interview shows sometimes have to deal with.
We'll really do the gamut of everything, not just tech or business. I had started to move out of my concentric circles. I had done all the tech people, and then I did a lot of big business people because they were impacted by tech, but tech was always the formation of it. Hmm. And then it moved out to, I did a lot of politics in the last year or two, or 2 years since, maybe three. So I was moving outward already. And I think the New York Times, if you define it as power and what it is in this country, because that's really what's happening right now, it's shifts in power and who has it and how do you get it, how do you take right. it. I think really does sort of explain it. And it gives me permission to talk to just about anybody about that stuff.
Now, being in the midst of an election year seems like a perfect time to be interrogating power and the people who have it. Who are some of the guests she's had on the show?
So the show launched in late September with Nancy Pelosi as the first guest, talking about, you know, the current state of the Democrats. And since then, she's talked with your governor, Gavin Newsom. She's talked with Elon Musk. She's interviewed the chief scientific advisor for Operation Warp Speed. And her most recent episode, which came out earlier this week, is with Planned Parenthood CEO Alexis Miguel Johnson, talking about how the organization plans for Supreme Court with Amy Coney Barrett on the bench. So it kind of runs the gamut.
Now, when we talk about power, we also need to talk about those without power, the powerless. So if I were to listen to Kira's podcast, how am I going to feel about the state of things these days, Nick?
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, I can totally empathize with that. So yeah. I asked her a similar question and more in the form of, like, how do you keep so like hopeful and energetic in the face of all this difficulty? And here's what she had to say.
I don't know why I'm so up given how dire everything is. Like, I have no idea why that is. But I still do think that individual people at a price can change things. And I want to put a focus on both the bad people doing these things and understanding their evil natures, essentially, and the good people. And I think that really great big ideas do move humanity forward.
She mentions ideas, Nick. What sorts of ideas is she discussing on the show?
So in that moment specifically, she was talking about the Tony Kushner play Angels in America and how it had a profound effect on her life. And that's part of the contention she said she's going to try to make the show, which is like figuring out exploring how power comes from all these different places that may not be perceived as having power in the conventional sense. And so like, you know, ideas, anything ranging from like big philosophical ideas to, you know, artistic and emotional ideas like a play.
Talking to Nick Kwa. He hosts the LA Studios podcast about podcasts called Servant of Pod. Now, Nick, I want to talk broader about the New York Times podcasting universe. Earlier this year, the company acquired Serial Productions, the company behind the popular podcast Serial, and its first release with them was Nice White Parents.
From Serial Productions, it's Nice White Parents, a new show about the 60-year relationship between white parents and the public school down the block. I'm Hannah Jaffe.
What do you make of that acquisition and how that podcast has been received?
Well, personally, I thought it was an extremely smart acquisition for all sides. Everybody gets to kind of have what they want here. The Times get to add this like wildly powerful and known asset to their audio operations.
Yeah.
The Serial people get to cash in on the podcast boom without having to cater to like a corporate, just like Spotify. I mean, the Times is itself a kind of a corporate thing, but whatever. And both sides get to greatly improve the circumstances of their journalism. So, you know, I had been wondering about Serial Productions, whether they were like looking at all these big money acquisitions happening. And I was wondering if they were like, they got bought for how much, you know?
Yeah.
Nice White Parents specifically was pretty well received, I think. I haven't checked in on the actual download numbers yet, but it definitely drove a lot of conversation. It definitely drove a lot of interest. And I remember when I reviewed it for Vulture a couple of months ago, I got a ton of reader emails about it. So it's definitely something that's very quietly sort of moving the culture a little bit.
You know, Nick, whenever I hear of a radio station or a television station hiring someone with a newspaper background, a print background to, you know, help their product or advance their product, I always wonder, well, you know, it kind of, you kind of take up, you need a background in what you're getting into to help advance it. But the New York Times has done, I think, an amazing job with their podcast. So how would you characterize the brand of the New York Times podcast and their approach to developing and launching shows?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, from the process side of it, you know, we're talking about a situation in which they brought in these veteran radio and audio experts, largely drafted from public radio, but not always. Mm-hmm. And I think the task there was sort of like building a system in which they can figure out how to translate the sort of print reporters and digital reporters over into the audio field in an effective manner. So there's a lot of, you know, cross-medium collaboration and thinking happening. You know, we know that they're very interested in audio and making more audio shows and building out like an odd Times audio sound. It's still being shaped in many ways. We know that they want to do it in a way that feels polished, that feels like a really vivid and new-sounding documentary, and that they're trying to push forward what the aesthetics of audio journalism. But we also know that like there's some risks with that. I mean, most recently, the Times audio operations came under some scrutiny when the subject of one of its signature podcasts, Caliphate, which is an audio series that came out a couple years ago, that subject was essentially arrested for lying about his identity as like a former ISIS terrorist, which raised all sorts of questions about the reporter, about the show, about the process. But that is sort of, they're sort of like walking that wire of trying to do something new and reinvent the form in a bunch of different ways and reinvent journalism in a bunch of different ways. But there are definitely a sense of sensitivities and difficulties with that.
Yeah, yeah. We mentioned before that The Daily airs on KPCC. I'm kind of curious in this day and age, Nick, what benefit do you think it is for a podcast to air on the radio?
So podcasting is a fast-growing medium. And I want to underscore that The Daily is a like a juggernaut. I just got a confirmation earlier today that like they're averaging 4 million downloads per weekday episode. That's just a crazy number. But the fact of the matter is that like, you know, 4 million or not, like there's still a lot of people out there who, you know, don't know what a podcast is. You know, the podcasting as a sort of a media format is still kind of wonky to consume. So like, you know, no disrespect to people in their 60s and 70s, it might be hard for people in their 60s and 70s to like access that journalism. So like there is benefit to syndicating on a radio and as a manner to, you know, grow reach, grow impact, grow interest. And I should say, you know, that's kind of why I'm here talking to you too, you know? Like, you know, listen to Servant of Pod, folks. It's a good show.
Absolutely. Nick Kwa hosts the LA Studios podcast about podcasts, Servant of Pod. Find it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you like to listen. Nick, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And And while you're searching for Servant of Pod, why don't you look up your old pals here, Take Two. There we will be waiting to be heard by you. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two is back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.